Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Gail Sulick will be on to discuss the problems with the sea of pink ribbons that are supposed to save us all from breast cancer. Also, healthcare reform starts to hit some hurdles, and right-wing groups that are labeled as hate groups revolt. But the evidence shows that they are, in fact, hate groups. Last week, I discussed an assault on AIDS-related art at the Smithsonian. Some conservative politicians are grandstanding on the issue, and Stephen Colbert made fun of them.
That is why I'm giving a tip of my hat to incoming House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who said of the piece, "This is an obvious attempt to offend Christians during the Christmas season. The museum should pull the exhibit and be prepared for serious questions come budget time." Of course, this drew all kinds of fire from art critics who, no surprise, just don't get Cantor's work. This defunding threat isn't some cheap exercise in mindless censorship. It's an anti-paradigmatic revolutionary work of conceptual art banning. And while its point of departure may be Senator Jesse Helms' admittedly groundbreaking defunding of the National Endowment for the Arts over Andre Serrano's Piss Christ, it's not a derivative, "Ooh, I'm a Christian, I'm so offended," because as the only Jewish Republican in Congress, Cantor's outrage on behalf of Christians and Christmas is a liminal journey into the cultural wound, exploding our narrow preconceptions of what it means to pander.
He goes on at length, and the best part is that it all actually makes sense. Anyone who thought that healthcare reform was a done deal is someone who pays no attention to American politics, where even child labor laws can be contested in grumpy tones, and where you occasionally hear conservatives grousing about women having the right to vote. Oh yeah, and Social Security is always being threatened. Few things are ever put completely beyond the wall of not being up for discussion. And so the healthcare bill may have passed into law, but the battle has just begun in many ways. There was a recent and interesting setback, albeit one that was quite expected.
A federal judge in Virginia ruled today that a key part of the overhaul violates the Constitution. It mandates Americans to have health insurance coverage. With the bill now just starting to go into effect, what does this mean for families in America? Jake Tapper tells us. He joins us from the White House tonight. Jake.
Good evening, Diane. That's right. White House officials expect that this case will end up before the Supreme Court at issue, as you say.
Calm down, Diane Sawyer. It's not nearly as exciting as she's making it out to sound. The Attorney General of Virginia, Ken Cuccinelli, deliberately sought out Judge Henry Hudson because he's super conservative and a reliable right-winger. On top of that, the only aspect of the vast bill that's under scrutiny is the individual mandate, which requires you to buy insurance or pay a tax penalty to the IRS. That part could be overturned, leaving the rest of the healthcare reform intact. Rachel Maddow brought Dahlia Lithwick on to talk about the implications.
Commerce Clause, in terms of the constitutional ruling here, does this ruling today say more about the law itself, or does it say more about the varietals of justice that we have? I mean, Judge Henry Hudson, everybody who cares about this today knows, has a long history as a Republican political activist in Virginia. He was seen as being sort of the best potential political shot for Ken Cuccinelli's lawsuit in Virginia. Is this the case of just this landing before the right judge, and this doesn't necessarily tell us what might happen if, for example, this gets kicked up to the Supreme Court?
Well, it's certainly not, again, a complete coincidence that the two judges who have upheld the health reform legislation so far have been Clinton appointees. And, you know, I think observers are making great hay of the fact that this seems to say more about who appointed you than your views of the Constitution. But
I don't want to be a Pollyanna about this. There's always a possibility that this could be curtains for healthcare reform. But my feeling right now is that this lawsuit and ruling are mostly going to be symbolic, a way for healthcare opponents to suggest their arguments are legitimate. And the important thing for them is to be able to grouse more than it is to actually change the law, especially since the law has goodies for voters and insurance companies. Specifically, I think Cuccinelli is about 99% in this to grandstand, even though it's not going to come around to much.
For now, we've beaten it back here in Virginia. Of course, we will see where the final decision brings us. But if we cross this line with health care now, this unconstitutional line, where the government can force us to buy a private product and say it's for our own good, then we'll have given the government the power to force us to buy other products, cars, gym memberships, asparagus, the list goes on.
This entire speech is just silly. For one thing, the individual mandate actually isn't the use of force. You cannot go to jail for not having health insurance, unlike car insurance, which you can go to jail for not owning. It's just a tax penalty, and you're well within your rights to say that you'd rather pay more taxes than for insurance. Second of all, there's the slippery slope fallacy. Individual mandates are common in other countries with universal health care, and no one requires you to buy asparagus. But I do like Cuccinelli's idea of a horrible world as one where people eat their greens. This is just one example of how the new Republican majority is going to grandstand on health care reform. Representative Steve King was on about attacking it from the legislative stance.
We address the repeal of Obamacare. I believe, and I believe that leadership is consistent with me on this, that we should bring a bill that's a clean repeal, a standalone repeal of Obamacare, send that over to the Senate, and get them working on the repeal of Obamacare. Now, we know that the president would veto that if it gets to his desk, but that we need a test vote so we know where people stand, and we can start marching down through the appropriations bills, every one of them, putting language in them that prohibits any of the funds that are appropriated from being used to either implement or enforce Obamacare.
So, in other words, they're going to spend time basically grandstanding some more. And they'll probably do this for a few more years until healthcare reform really starts to become an integral part of people's lives. And then campaigning heavily against it will start to make people dislike you. So they'll back off this talk of repeal and instead have their think tanks work on ways to reframe repeal so that people think it's not going to be repeal. You know, like they did with Social Security. Hopefully, like with Social Security, healthcare reform will only grow stronger with time and gain inertia that makes repeal impossible.
I'd like to welcome Gail Sulick to the program. Gail is a medical sociologist, author, and health advocate. She's recently published a book called Pink Ribbon Blues, How Breast Cancer Culture Undermines Women's Health. And she's here today to talk about breast cancer and her new book. Welcome to RealityCast, Gail.
Thank you for having me.
Your book takes a look at the cultural messages around breast cancer, which you find troubling. Let's start with your critiques of the image of the heroic breast cancer survivor. What is this image and what's wrong with it?
The heroic survivor, the Shiro, is the name given to this image, this caricature, really, in the book. And this is the image of, and it's an idealized version of the survivor, the feminine hero, the Shiro. She kicks cancer's butt, does it with a smile on her face, possibly even with 6-inch heels, and she fights breast cancer and wins, and she does it with style. She would be the woman, the pink ribbon wearing woman who would optimistically go out and share her story with others and be very open about the positive aspects and the transcendent aspects of her experience with breast cancer. And so while I know some people who have tried to live up to that ideal image, I know that it doesn't work for a lot of people. Especially women who are diagnosed later or who have recurrences. It's very, very difficult to uphold that image and that style and the optimism that goes along with it. The other aspect of the Shiro is that more recently, and Peggy Orenstein writes about this in the New York Times. More recently, there is a sexualized aspect to survivorship as well. And we also see that as part of the Shiro.
So what is this sexualized aspect?
Well, many of the images that we see around breast cancer, if you look at advertising, and there's actually a lot of advertising, both in cause marketing as well as in promotional materials for community events and educational events and those kinds of things. And often we'll see images of smiling women, made-up women. And in ads, we often see a lot of skin. And it's fascinating that in ads and cause marketing ads for breast cancer, we see a lot of cleavage. And so that sexualized aspect that not only should the woman who is diagnosed be transformed, but she should look the part and she should look sexy in the part. She should be fully restored both emotionally and physically.
Do you find that women that are struggling with or surviving breast cancer are feeling pressured to be extremely sexy on top of, you know, just making it to the other side?
There is the first piece of it is to look normal. And what is normal, right? Normal basically being able to wear clothing, fashionable clothing, feminine clothing. And so the first step of it for a lot of women after the diagnosis, if they have mastectomies, is to somehow restore either through prosthetics or through medical reconstruction so that they actually look like a woman, look feminine. And so that's one piece of it. And then beyond that, part of that is a sexiness. And I know of some women after reconstruction, they're very happy that they can have cleavage again. They can show cleavage. And even if the reconstruction is not complete, if they can have an image of evenness and images of full breasts and cleavage, then that's very important to them.
One of the biggest parts of pink ribbon culture is all these awareness efforts, which are drenched in pink. Why is breast cancer awareness not all that it's cracked up to be?
Yeah, I think it's most basically because the awareness is at a very surface level. In many ways, awareness means just simply visibility. Hey, pink ribbon, breast cancer. Maybe added on to that is get your mammogram. But there's nothing really deep about what that awareness means. And so the ribbon, as we're swimming around in the sea of pink, we basically just see that it's there. And the depth of what awareness means falls into the background. And often it never surfaces. And so getting evidence-based information out about breast cancer is what really needs to happen.
One of the aspects of the sort of breast cancer awareness, et cetera, movement that has always alarmed me is you see the word prevention being bandied around a lot. And that strikes me as a really misleading term. Can you explain the problems with trotting out prevention as a focus in our current environment?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. And current environment could be social, cultural, political, or environmental, right? And so thinking about what prevention means, often prevention is translated to be screening, when in fact screening is not prevention. Screening, if it does a good job, and it's questionable about when and how it does a good job, is secondary prevention at best. It's identifying something that's already there. And so primary prevention would be to avoid the disease altogether. Incidence rates go down. And so often we really don't have a focus on how is it that we can create an environment that is actually hostile to cancer. And instead, because we haven't figured that out and actually haven't even put a lot of research attention to that, the focus is what can we do now? And the best case scenario that a number of people have come up with is, well, let's try to detect it. But the screening controversy, which has been ongoing for some time, at least 10 years, if not longer, has found many problems in terms of accuracy, with screening, mammography, false positives, false negatives. And if it's not something we can really count on wholeheartedly, then to put so much of our focus there is really going to detract our attention from other ways that we might really think about how do we avoid this disease altogether.
One of the more recent criticisms you're seeing cropping up a lot is from women saying that, criticizing the focus on awareness efforts to young women, which they a lot of people are afraid that that's just teaching young women to treat their breasts like they're just time bombs that are about to go off. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, there is a lot of fear going around. And also when you go back to the sexualization and the bodies and the skin and the ads, you also see young women. And so while breast cancer does occur in women under 40, and about 5% of cases fall into that category, it really is more of a disease of women, you know, 55 and older. And you tend not to see those women. So you tend to see the younger women. You tend to see the sexualization push, the I Love Boobies bracelets and all of the Project Boobies stuff that's going on. You see that aimed at younger women. And alongside that is breast self-exam, which in many ways is that's questionable as well. And you see the probability of 1 in 8, that 1 in 8 women in their lifetime will be diagnosed. So be afraid, be very afraid. And beyond that 1 in 8, there's not a whole lot of understanding about what that means. And what it really means is that over a lifetime of 80 years, 1 in 8 women, if they don't die of something else, are likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer. But when you're in your 30s, that number is about 1 in 209, 216. And so it's not that 1 in 8, hey, everybody in the, you know, 8 people in a room, one of them is going to get breast cancer.
Every time I blog about this, I always get commenters who accuse me of being a poopy head joy killer. And they say that I'm just being critical to be critical and that I should be glad that anyone cares at all, however imperfectly. I'm sure you get the same responses. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I don't believe that any awareness is good awareness. And for a number of reasons that are outlined in detail in the book, and some that we've already talked about, there is misinformation that comes along with it. And so if the kind of awareness that we have is not necessarily awareness that's going to help people either to avoid the disease altogether or to get support with the many possible ways that we might deal with and face breast cancer, then I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. It's actually creating difficulties and a lack of support for women who may want to face breast cancer differently.
And if somebody said to you, what's the harm? What's the harm of pushing self-exam and, you know, mammograms if they're not, even if they're not as effective as we'd hope they are, like, is there any real danger in having so many women invested in monitoring their own bodies religiously for cancer?
I think that the issues around, well, they're really different things. So we could talk about breast self-exam first and then screening. For BSC, there has not been shown to be any survival benefit for women who do a monthly breast self-exam compared to women who don't. So if you do the breast self-exam every month and you think, okay, if I eventually find something during my monthly exam, I'm going to be ahead of the curve because I found it and I found it early. The reality is that most of the time it's not going to be found early because cancer's in the body for 8 to 10 years before it becomes visible. So to rely on BSC, it's good to know your body. It's good to know all parts of your body, all aspects of your body. That's a positive thing. But to think that it's going to save you from breast cancer, that's misinformation. So there might be a false sense of security around BSC. And then a similar thing can happen with screening. And to think about screening, there's a difference between screen the entire population of women regularly at a certain age, see if they have anything abnormal, and, hey, there's something abnormal that either a clinical exam or a woman has noticed, so let's diagnostically check that. And mammograms for that purpose have people are generally in agreement, doctors are in agreement that that's a good thing to do. But to screen the whole population at a certain age as if all women are the same tends to not be necessarily the best thing to do. And so what we see with that is there's also the false sense of security in thinking that I had my mammogram at 40 or at 50, came back negative, I'm fine, and yet mammograms will miss 25 to 40% of tumors that actually are cancerous. So that's a negative. And then in addition to that, about anywhere between 75 to 90% of abnormalities on a mammogram actually turn out not to be cancer. And so that can lead to increases in overdiagnosis and over-treatment of women, which can have its own negative effects.
My guest today has been Gail Sulick, and her book is called Pink Ribbon Blues: How Breast Cancer Culture Undermines Women's Health. You can learn more by going to GAYLESULIK.com. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Gail.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
There's an interesting controversy of sorts broiling now that the Southern Poverty Law Center has declared many anti-gay groups to be hate groups. Since overt anti-gay bigotry is mainstream in a way that overt racism isn't, this has caused some confusion. People have trouble believing, for instance, that you can be in a hate group and testify in front of Congress. But this is true of Tony Perkins of the Family Research Institute / Council. We shouldn't be surprised, actually. In the 1920s, it was common for the Ku Klux Klan members to be in mainstream politics. We just haven't, as a society, gotten to the point where anti-gay bigotry is universally condemned to the point where it goes completely underground. Mark Potok of SPLC went on the David Pakman show to explain why the Family Research Institute is a hate group. I think their definition is very conservative in the sense that you have to be pretty overtly hateful to get on the list. Burying your hate, as anti-choicers do, under rhetoric that sounds nicer is often enough to get you off the list.
We were on with Chris Matthews and Tony Perkins recently, and I watched that with great interest. And of course, Tony Perkins denied the alleged hate group status of the Family Research Council, and he is one of those 18 groups on your list. How do you define a hate group, first of all, I think is the best way to start?
Well, it's not a, well, let me say, you know, as a general matter, hate groups are groups which say in their platform statements, on their websites, in the writings or speeches of their leaders, that an entire group of human beings, based on their class characteristics, are somehow less. So at least our evaluation of hate groups has nothing to do with criminality or some kind of estimate we're making of their potential for violence. It's
right.
You know, if you say all white people are blue-eyed devils or all black people are you know, wicked criminals or whatever it may be, that's hate group status for us.
Right-Wing Watch has been monitoring the reaction to this announcement very carefully. As you can imagine, pro-homo bigotry activists are not happy with the SPLC's decision. What's funny is that Tony Perkins and Peter Sprigg of the Family Research Council talk about gay people in exactly the same way you'd find anti-Semitic groups talking about Jews.
It's kind of a crown jewel for the homosexuals, really. If they can take over the military and force open homosexuality, very little stands in their way.
Well, that's right. I mean, they've already succeeded in taking over ideologically taking over the liberal institutions of society, the academia, the news media, and the entertainment media. They want to take over the conservative institutions of society, like the military, so that there will be no opposition to them at all.
The notion that there's a secret cabal of people that are infiltrating and taking over society in an organized fashion, that's the protocols of the Elders of Zion right there. The funniest part is that these two were screeching about how unfair it is to be called a hate group on this very same episode. But they proved the accuracy of the designation right there. They're also rebundling the same old lies about gay people that the bigots have always trotted out.
But one of the issues that seems to bother them the most, which I've had to debate now on a couple of TV programs, is the connection between, and this is what the social science, the peer-reviewed data shows, a correlation between homosexuality and pedophilia. That seems to be a real problem with them.
The evidence for his assertion that there's a connection between homosexuality and pedophilia is a bunch of so-called peer-reviewed research. And by peer, he means he made a bunch of stuff up and then had his friends read it. It's not the actual peer review you or I would understand as peer review. And just the other day, I noted on Twitter that Tony Perkins spends his free time kicking puppies. My friends read that, so now it's a peer-reviewed fact. See how that works? But what they're really doing here is basically repackaging the old assertion that gays recruit children and trying to dress it up in language that says that without saying it. Also, they only seem to think sexual assault of children is a problem insofar as dudes are seeing wieners, as Peter LaBarra of Americans for Truth About Homosexuality makes clear.
Pedophilia in and of itself is perverse, but the idea of seducing a boy is homosexual. It's an aspect of homosexuality. It doesn't mean that all gay men are child abusers. It doesn't mean that every gay man wants to molest a boy. But the question I have is, why are there so many boy victims? And obviously because it's an aspect of the larger deviance. It's a subset of the larger deviance of homosexuality.
It's truly fascinating that he feels that the level of boys being molested is the real problem, but seems just fine with the level of girls being molested, I guess as long as they're being molested by men. Or maybe he's implying that child molestation tends to have more male than female victims, so he can pin this one on gay men. In reality, prepubescent girls are twice as likely as prepubescent boys to be sexually assaulted. Also, research into the sexual orientation of people who assault children has shown that most are oriented solely towards children. But the second highest group were people who had heterosexual relationships with adults. Bisexuals came next, and homosexuals were the tiniest fraction of people who molested children. In the post-pubescent minor population, again, girls are far more likely to be victims. In fact, girls 16 to 19 are four more times likely to be sexually assaulted than the general population. My feeling on this is that these folks are indeed professional bigots and should be classified as such. Accusations about gay men are lies, and they seem to be especially obsessed with gay men, probably because what really offends them is the idea that someone male might actually be treated like a sex object, something they would reserve only for women and girls.
When I get down, you know I get down.
And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Now things have really gotten grotesque edition. Choir singers for the conservative Christian Liberty University decided it would just be awesome to do a choral version of the Anton Dodson video that was turned into a song that spread like wildfire because people thought it was just so hilarious that this man was agitated because someone tried to rape his sister. The one good aspect is that conservative enthusiasm for making fun of a man who saved his sister from being raped has clarified why there's something deeply screwed up about the popularity of this video.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.